The federal news update for Wednesday, December 24th, 2025. Welcome to the deep dive. This is where we take what is, I have to say, an incredibly dense stack of federal sources, all the documents, all the research, and we boil it all down. We distill it into the key insights you need to really understand what's happening inside the government.
And this period, the 48 hours covering December 23rd and 24th, it was really defined by this incredible tension. A push and pull.
It really was. Yeah, We're looking at a genuine constitutional inflection point here. You have the judiciary putting very firm checks on executive power in one area domestically.
Right.
And at the same time, you see this incredibly aggressive, almost unilateral assertion of that same power everywhere else. Mm. Foreign policy, drug enforcement, deep regulatory changes. It's really a study in how power adapts when it's blocked.
That dual narrative is exactly it. Constraint on one side and just pure acceleration on the other. And all of this is happening while most of the government is supposedly shutting down for a 5-day holiday break.
Which feels deliberate.
It feels very deliberate. I mean, we're not just talking about minor tweaks. These are major long-term policy shifts being pushed through, you know, almost in the dark. So our mission today is to cover every single reported activity, look at the immediate impacts, but also those deeper policy shifts, and crucially, show you how all of these seemingly separate events are actually connected.
Absolutely. The civil service might have been heading home for the holidays, but the strategic machinery of the state was clearly speeding up. The sheer volume of these high-stakes decisions suggests the administration was pushing its most controversial items right before the Capitol went quiet.
So we have to start where those constitutional battle lines were drawn most clearly. That's the Supreme Court's definitive, and I think, frankly, surprising, check on the domestic use of military force. This is the decision that really forced the executive branch to pivot on everything else.
Okay, let's unpack that. This is the monumental decision that dropped on December 23rd, the Supreme Court's 6-3 ruling in Trump v. Illinois.
Case number 25A443.
And this ruling denied the administration's emergency request, the stay application, for what they were calling Operation Midway Blitz.
Right. This was the plan to federalize National Guard units from Illinois and Texas to conduct interior immigration enforcement operations in Chicago.
So what's the immediate on-the-ground effect of this ruling?
It's stark, and it's mandatory. The Illinois and Texas National Guard units that were federalized for this, that were operating in the Chicago area, they have to demobilize. Instantly.
It's not just a pause. It's a full stop.
It's a full stop. It completely dismantles a cornerstone of the administration's entire interior enforcement strategy. It leaves this huge operational vacuum that civilian agencies like ICE and Border Patrol now have to try and fill. Or, you know, they have to abandon the mission in that area altogether.
And the court got there how? I understand it was based on a very, very specific reading of one statute. For those of us who, you know, don't have Title 10 of the U.S. Code memorized, can you break down that core legal finding?
I'd be worried if you did. Yes, the entire legal fight, the whole thing, it hinged on just a handful of words in 10 U.S.C. Section 12-4063.
Okay.
That's the statute that lets the president federalize the guard when he is, quote, unable with the regular forces to execute the laws.
Unable with the regular forces. So the whole fight was about what regular forces actually means.
Precisely. The administration's argument was, let's say, expansive. They claimed regular forces should mean all federal law enforcement, ICE, FPS, Customs and Border Protection, GEA, you name it.
The whole federal toolkit.
The whole toolkit.
Yeah.
But the court delivered this really strict historical textualist smackdown. They held that regular forces is a term of art. It has a specific meaning. It refers only to the professional standing United States military.
So the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Space Force, yep. Not civilian law enforcement.
Exactly. Only them, which, as you can imagine, sets an almost impossibly high bar for the executive branch.
Yeah, right. Because the president can't just say that, you know, IC is overwhelmed. He'd have to demonstrate that the actual standing combat-ready military is unable to handle what is, at the end of the day, a domestic law enforcement task.
He would. But this is where the legal craftsmanship gets really fascinating, where the court created what you could call a self-sealing statutory loop. And they did it using the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878.
Okay, so bring Posse Comitatus into it. How does that fit?
Well, the court reasoned that since Posse Comitatus already prohibits the standing, regular military from engaging in routine domestic law enforcement things. Things like detaining civilians or conducting searches.
Which is exactly what this operation was about.
Exactly. Then the military is therefore legally unable to execute those specific laws anyway.
Wait, okay, let me see if I have this straight. The law that would let you activate the guard is triggered when the regular military is unable to act.
Correct.
But the very reason the military is unable to act is because another law, Posse Comitatus, says they're not allowed to.
You've got it. It is a brilliant, if, as you said, utterly restrictive piece of judicial logic.
It sounds like a lawyer's joke, a perfect circle.
It's judicial consistency. And it leaves the administration with nowhere to go under that specific statute. Unless you're talking about a genuine high-stakes scenario, like a declared insurrection or an invasion, which trigger entirely different, much more severe legal authorities, you can't use this section as a general-purpose tool for domestic police work.
Whether that's immigration or drug enforcement or riot control.
It's neutered. The court effectively neutered that statute for the president's current interior enforcement goals.
Which brings us to the administration's next move. Their frequent workaround for Posse Comitatus, which is the protective functions argument, they claim the troops weren't doing law enforcement, they were just protecting federal property and personnel.
And the court saw that coming a mile away. They spotted the attempt to have it both ways.
How so?
They countered by saying, look, if these protective functions are not executing the laws for the purpose of avoiding Posse Comitatus.
So they don't violate the ban on military law enforcement.
Right. If that's your argument, then those same functions cannot simultaneously be the basis for invoking Section 4063, which, by its own explicit language, is a statute for when the president is trying to execute the laws.
You can't have it both ways.
You can't claim an activity is both not executing laws to get around one statute and is executing laws to trigger another. It was just a masterful, devastating piece of legal logic.
So what does this mean operationally, in the short term? This can't just be about Chicago.
No, not at all. It creates a powerful, crystal clear legal roadmap for immediate and frankly successful injunctions to block similar deployments all over the country.
Los Angeles, Portland, New York.
Any of them. Operations that involve the Guard or the regular military in support of interior immigration enforcement are now legally vulnerable. This precedent will almost certainly lead to successful challenges in lower courts nationwide. The White House now has to either rely solely on its civilian agencies or completely change its strategy.
And that strategy change raises the big long-term specter that analysts are already pointing to, the idea that the president might be forced to invoke the full-scale Insurrection Act.
That is the ultimate constitutional showdown this decision sets up for 2026. If this lower statutory bar is blocked, the administration may feel like they only have the quote-unquote nuclear option left.
Which is a much higher bar to clear, politically.
Much higher. The Insurrection Act requires a different level of declared political necessity. It carries far greater risks, both at home and abroad. It would transform what was a legal debate into a full-blown political crisis.
We do have to note, though, that the 6-3 split in the court shows some pretty deep ideological fissures here, even within the majority. Justice Kavanaugh, for instance, who was the decisive sixth vote, he wrote a very narrow concurrence.
He did. It was a procedural concurrence. He basically suggested that the president had failed to explicitly make the formal finding that the military was unable to act. He implied that a future, more carefully drafted executive finding might fix the problem.
So he left the door open a crack.
He did, though notably he avoided challenging that core Posse Comitatus loop analysis itself. It felt like an invitation to the White House to try again, but, you know, with better paperwork next time.
Which is a very different tone from Justice Alito's dissent.
Oh, completely different. A vigorous 16-page dissent, joined by Justices Thomas and Gorsuch. Alito argued for maximum executive authority, citing the old 1827 precedent of Martin v. Mott.
And that case says what?
It grants the president exclusive power to determine if a crisis exists that requires using state forces. The minority's argument was essentially that the judiciary shouldn't substitute its judgment for the president's assessment of national security.
So it was an intense moment. The judiciary draws this hard line on December 23rd. But the White House, rather than sort of retreat or slow down, they immediately and aggressively pivoted.
Yes.
They asserted this expanded authority in totally different areas where their unilateral power is strongest, specifically through executive orders.
The defeat in Chicago seemed to trigger an immediate and aggressive countermove everywhere else.
And that pivot is the theme here, isn't it? The judiciary blocks a military option under Title 10, the law enforcement title, so the executive immediately goes looking for a different authority.
And that brings us directly to the first major action published on December 23rd, the designation of illicit fentanyl and its chemical precursors as a weapon of mass destruction, a WMD.
which is a profound policy game changer. Just that designation itself recodifies the entire problem.
It does. By unilaterally designating fentanyl a WMD, the whole legal and operational mission shifts instantly. It moves the fight out of the traditional criminal justice lane, which is Title 21, Food and Drugs Authority.
And moves it where?
Into the much broader, much more powerful Title 50 authorities, war and national defense. This is the government deciding to treat the fentanyl crisis as a national security threat on par with nuclear or biological weapons.
So what does that feel like on the ground? What's the immediate operational impact of switching from Title 21 to Title 50?
It provides enormous new resources and legal flexibility. And crucially, it allows the Secretary of Defense to provide enhanced national security resources to federal agencies that are fighting the cartels.
And enhanced national security resources means what in practice?
It translates directly to the potential deployment of specialized, highly trained National Guard WMD civil support teams. These are the CSTs who are specifically trained for sampling, analysis, and hazardous material containment. It also unlocks advanced intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets, ISR.
Drones, sensors, signal intelligence, the kind of stuff normally reserved for counterterrorism overseas.
Exactly. And this is the genius of the executive workaround, isn't it? The fentanyl WMD designation creates a legal pathway for military assets to operate domestically, but under the guise of hazardous material containment, not law enforcement.
Which gets them around the posse comitatus restrictions we were just talking about.
Precisely. They are leveraging the military's expertise in containing dangerous chemicals, which is a protective function. They're using a Title 50 national security threat instead of the Title 10 law enforcement authority that the Supreme Court just constrained. Mm. It's like three-dimensional constitutional chess.
And this designation has a financial component too, right? It has teeth.
It has immense financial teeth. They're engaging in sophisticated financial warfare at the same time. The order directs the Treasury Department to apply WMD proliferation sanctions, which are far harsher than standard drug sanctions, against cartels and, critically, against their Chinese chemical suppliers.
And that's the key.
That's the key, because it exposes any foreign banks that process those transactions to severe secondary sanctions. It can essentially cut them off from the entire U.S. financial system, which is the ultimate hammer. And this links directly to FinCEN's recent announcement of a new data-driven border operation. The intelligence and financial arms of the government are now focused on that fentanyl supply chain.
At the exact same time, we saw this massive, and I have to say, paradoxical regulatory shift in the cannabis space. This was under Executive Order 14370. Let's start with the liberalization part, which is huge news for the legal industry.
It is. The EO directs the Attorney General to expedite rulemaking to reschedule marijuana, moving it from Schedule 1.
Which means high abuse potential, no accepted medical use.
Right. Down to Schedule 3, which acknowledges moderate to low abuse potential and accepted medical uses. And for the legal cannabis industry, in states where it's permitted, this is just an immense financial lifeline. It's an overnight gift.
And that gift is all about one specific, very punitive piece of the tax code, Internal Revenue Code, Section 280E.
Correct. As long as cannabis is Schedule 1, Section 280E prohibits those businesses from deducting standard business expenses, payroll, rent, utilities, marketing, things every other business in America deducts.
So they're taxed on their gross revenue, not their profit.
Which is crippling. Moving to Schedule 3 fully exempts them from 280E. They can deduct all those costs just like a normal business. Analysts are estimating this will effectively double the net income for many legal operators. At a minimum, it's a 50 to 100% boost in profit margins. It makes a multi-billion dollar industry financially sustainable overnight.
But then there's the paradox. As you said, a hand giving and another one taking away, especially when it comes to the unregulated products.
Indeed. The same EO directs agencies to aggressively close the so-called Farm Bill loophole, which came out of the 2018 Farm Bill that legalized hemp.
And that loophole has allowed for this explosion of things like Delta 8 THC, the stuff you see in convenience stores and smoke shops.
Exactly. All those unregulated, intoxicating hemp-derived products operating in a gray market. The new statutory definitions will enforce a strict 0.3% total THC cap. No more loopholes. That will effectively ban many of these products that are currently legal. So the administration is clearly trading, you know, legalization and financial support for the regulated medical market in exchange for a total prohibition of the gray intoxicating hemp market. That's a cleanup job.
And there was one more provision in that EO, one that got a little overlooked, but it seems truly groundbreaking, a pilot program for Medicare.
This is huge. a pilot program for Medicare reimbursement of certain CBD treatments, starting in April 2026. This is especially important for the elderly population. It legitimizes cannabis-derived compounds as actual reimbursable medicine at the federal level for the first time in U.S. history. It signals a major, enduring shift in federal health policy.
Okay, so from drugs and health, let's go to the cosmos. Another significant executive order, Ensuring American Space Superiority, published on December 23rd. This feels like it's setting a very aggressive new pace.
It does. This order is a clear declaration of intent. It's about reestablishing overwhelming U.S. dominance in space, and it's framed as essential for both national security and economic growth.
What are the key directives?
The big ones are a non-negotiable, aggressive 2028 deadline for establishing a sustained moon base. Not just a flag planting, but a sustained presence.
A base.
A base. And the construction of a Golden Dome prototype, which is basically the infrastructure you'd need for a permanent lunar or even orbital presence. The EO also puts a really strong emphasis on commercialization and competition. It makes it clear that space dominance, in their view, relies on the private sector and outcompeting rivals like China.
And then just before the Capitol went dark, the president formalized the holiday closure itself with Executive Order 14369.
Right. That provided for the closure of the federal government on Wednesday, December 24th, and Friday, December 26th.
Creating that five-day block where most of the civil service was offline.
The majority, yes. But the OPM memorandum that implemented the order had a very specific and I think very key clarification. It said employees necessary for national security, defense, or other public need must remain fully operational.
So given everything else that was happening.
Given the fentanyl WMD order being activated, the intense Taiwan crisis we're about to discuss, this meant that significant parts of DHS, DOD, and the intelligence community were operating at maximum tempo. They got no holiday break whatsoever. The closure was highly selective.
So these domestic actions, the WMD designation, the cannabis shift, the space race, they were expansive, they were unilateral, and they were really rapid countermoves to the judicial restraint we saw. But these were mirrored by equally aggressive moves on the global stage.
Absolutely. The administration's foreign policy offensive over these 48 hours was defined by two parallel high-risk objectives. First, initiating what really amounts to a diplomatic war with our European allies. And second, rapidly hardening our military posture against China in the Indo-Pacific.
Let's start on that diplomatic front. The State Department, under Secretary Rubio, announced visa restrictions on five European officials and activists on December 23rd. And they targeted what the administration is calling the Global Censorship Industrial Complex. That is some provocative language.
It's designed to be. I mean, this is an unprecedented move against individuals from historically close allied nations, France, Germany, the UK. And the action uses a very specific, very powerful provision in the law, Section 212A3C of the Immigration and Nationality Act.
And that lets the government do what?
It allows the U.S. to exclude any alien whose presence would have, quote, potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences. It's a broad authority.
So who were the specific targets here and why them?
They explicitly named the former EU Commissioner Thierry Breton, who was the main architect of the EU's big tech regulation, the Digital Services Act, or DSA. They accused him of extraterritorial censorship. They also targeted key figures from organizations the administration sees as pressuring American platforms. Imran Ahmed, the CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate, and Claire Melford, co-founder of the Global Disinformation Index. These are groups that were accused of creating disinformation ratings that led to the demonetization of conservative American news sites. And finally, two leaders from a German NGO called HateAid were named for their role in enforcing strict European content rules on global platforms.
So this is going way beyond a traditional diplomatic spat. The administration is framing foreign regulation of speech, even from our allies, as a direct threat to American ideological sovereignty, to the First Amendment itself.
That's the core message. The U.S. government is treating foreign entities that pressure American social media companies, you know, X or Meta to moderate content, as if they are hostile actors, as if they're trying to export their restrictive speech laws to U.S. soil. Secretary Rubio's statement made it clear this is something they will no longer tolerate.
And the practical threat here is real.
It's enormous. DHS could initiate removal proceedings if any of these individuals are currently in the United States. It effectively criminalizes the advocacy functions of international NGOs operating in D.C.
And the geopolitical fallout from this was, I assume, immediate and predictable?
Swift and severe. French President Emmanuel Macron publicly called the move intimidation, and coercion. The European Commission vigorously defended its autonomy under the DSA.
Mm-hmm.
This action, it critically fractures the transatlantic digital alliance that had been, you know, tenuously holding together on cyber issues. Analysts are already calling it the acceleration of the splinternet.
The splinternet?
Yeah, the idea of two distinct incompatible legal regimes for the internet. The EU model, focused on regulation and safety, and the US model, focused on First Amendment absolutism and freedom from foreign influence.
And while that diplomatic fire was burning, tensions were escalating just as fast in the Indo-Pacific. We saw the formal notification of the largest ever U.S. arms sale to Taiwan, a massive $11.1 billion package.
And it was explicitly designed to implement the Porcupine Strategy.
We should pause on that. What exactly is the Porcupine Strategy?
It's a fundamental shift in defense thinking for Taiwan. It moves away from trying to match China plane for plane, ship for ship, which is impossible.
Mm.
It focuses instead on asymmetric defense.
Meaning?
Meaning small, numerous, survivable, and very lethal systems that are designed to make any amphibious invasion prohibitively costly and complex for China to even attempt.
Hmm?
You make yourself a very painful target to attack, a porcupine.
So what were the key components in this historic $11 billion package?
The components perfectly reflect that asymmetry. Taiwan is getting 82 HIMARS launchers. Those are the highly mobile rocket systems. They're getting 420 ATACMS missiles, which are critical because they have a 300-kilometer range.
Yeah.
They can conduct deep strikes against PLA staging areas on the mainland.
And it wasn't just missiles.
No. Also, 60 M109A7 Paladin self-propelled howitzers for rapid coastal defense. And crucially, a $1.1 billion line item for loitering munitions, things like the Altius 600M and 700 era.
Which are essentially self-piloting kamikaze drones.
Designed for swarming attacks, yes. And the final $1 billion is dedicated to tactical mission command software to link all of Taiwan's sensors and shooters into one cohesive network.
That is a very direct, very clear military signal to Beijing and China's immediate response.
It was aggressive and immediate. On the 23rd and 24th, the PLA conducted combat readiness patrols with 22 military aircraft and naval vessels.
Mm.
And 18 of those aircraft crossed the median line of the Taiwan Strait, which is a severe escalation.
They also used some gray zone tactics, right?
They did. They officially blamed Taiwanese smugglers for damage to multiple subsea communication cables, a move clearly aimed at disrupting Taiwan's digital connectivity and testing their vulnerabilities without firing a shot.
And all of this has to be viewed in the context of a critical U.S. intelligence assessment that was released on the very same day.
A report noting that China has likely now fully loaded over 100 of its new intercontinental ballistic missiles ICBMs into their new silo fields.
Which exponentially raises the nuclear stakes of this whole confrontation.
It does. The administration is clearly in a high-stakes race to harden Taiwan's defenses before this window of vulnerability really opens up later in the decade, which coincides directly with this massive and until recently hidden nuclear buildup. It adds a terrifying urgency to that $11 billion sale.
And rounding out this global power play, we had the highly controversial Greenland diplomatic row. The president named Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry as a special envoy to Greenland on December 23rd.
And the rationale provided by the administration was framed purely as national security, a move to counter growing Russian and Chinese influence in the Arctic. They explicitly dismissed any idea of resource acquisition.
Despite the president's well-documented past interest in buying Greenland for its mineral wealth.
Exactly. And Governor Landry himself, in his video announcement, invoked the history of the Louisiana Purchase and said, Cajuns have lived under many flags. And then he made the deeply provocative statement that they want to bring Greenland into the U.S. system for liberty, opportunity, and security.
That kind of language, aimed at a sovereign territory of an ally, must have drawn a sharp, unified backlash.
Oh, absolutely. European leaders, Macron, Ursula von der Leyen from the European Commission, and both the Danish and Greenlandic prime ministers, they all issued extremely strong Jane statements. They condemned the action as intimidation and coercion. They emphasized Greenland's sovereignty. And they warned that this kind of action undermines the entire post-World War II order that protects small nations from being pressured by large ones. It was a profound diplomatic indictment.
So this flurry of foreign policy moves, the EU sanctions, the Taiwan sale, the Greenland envoy, it shows the executive branch flexing maximum muscle internationally. But that frantic operational tempo has put immense strain on the federal agencies supporting them, particularly on personnel and infrastructure.
And that leads us perfectly into a look inward. At the federal workforce itself, which faced this bizarre mix of harsh cuts and massive rewards, all announced around December 22nd and 23rd. Starting with the 2026 Continental Cost of Living Allowance, the COLA rates for DOD civilian staff.
And the COLA situation really reveals the financial stress on military families, doesn't it?
It does. The DOD announced that the COLA for civilian staff is shrinking significantly in several key high-cost areas. They cut the allowance entirely for 9 military housing areas. This includes major population centers where the cost of living is still stubbornly high, like Boston, and several expensive areas in California, San Luis Obispo, San Bernardino, Humboldt County, Riverside, Bridgeport.
And even cities that kept the COLA saw big cuts. I'm thinking of New York City.
Yes, New York City's rate was cut dramatically from 8% down to 4%.
Yeah.
I mean, for many DOD civilians in these areas, this is an immediate noticeable cut to their take-home pay.
Yeah.
And it just exacerbates the financial strains they're already feeling from inflation.
But the cuts weren't universal, which sort of highlights the, I don't know, the sometimes bizarre nature of how DOD calculates these things.
That's right. 8 military housing areas actually saw increases. Seattle saw the largest jump, going from 0 COL eligibility this year to a 5% rate in 2026. Oakland and San Francisco also saw increases, so it creates this very localized, very uneven impact.
But to offset some of that, perhaps to maintain morale, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth authorized some pretty significant cash bonuses on December 23rd.
This is a major move. Hegseth authorized cash bonuses up to a maximum of $25,000 for the top 15% of civilian employees. And the memo explicitly cited the uncertainty and adversity inherent in all periods of change, and specifically mentioned the strain from the longest government shutdown in American history.
So it's a retention tool, rewarding high performers to keep them during a period of high turnover.
Absolutely. And this civilian bonus structure, it mirrors the warrior dividend that was announced for service members, though sources clarify that's actually a one-time housing stipend.
Right. And it's funded by Congress through the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, not by tariff revenue, as was initially suggested.
That distinction is important. But the point stands. The administration is prioritizing performance incentives and retention packages, especially for its top-tier defense personnel.
And this focus on performance and incentives ties directly into what the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, is doing with modernization. Let's talk about the HR initiatives. They announced the hire of Don Bauer, the former State Department CTO, to lead this massive HR systems consolidation. And the irony here is just thick.
It's a fantastic bureaucratic twist.
Yeah.
Bauer famously wrote a column criticizing OPM's initial plan for this as not modernization, it's madness. And now he's coming back to government to lead the very effort he critiqued, this huge, incredibly complex project to consolidate 119 different HR systems across government by September 2027.
He called it an absolutely a hold my beer moment, acknowledging that criticism without service is cheap.
Which shows an administration that's willing to bring in sharp, even hostile outside critics, but only if they commit to taking ownership of the outcome. It's an internal recognition of just how hard this technical problem really is.
OPM is also trying to standardize how they groom future leaders. They proposed a new rule, published around December 18th, overhauling the Senior Executive Service Candidate Development Programs.
The goal here is consistency and, frankly, control. OPM noted the current programs are wildly inconsistent across agencies. The key changes are concrete. Shortening the program from 1 or 2 years down to a compressed 9 to 12 months, increasing required training hours, and mandating specific coaching and a 4-month developmental assignment.
And OPM was explicit that the goal is to align these candidates with new administration priorities and get them into jobs faster.
It is precisely that. It's an attempt to instill a unified, government-wide perspective into the SES Corps while accelerating the speed at which qualified, vetted candidates can move into critical positions. It builds right on the president's executive order calling for restored accountability in the SES.
But this forward-looking focus on the future workforce is completely overshadowed by a massive, immediate crisis impacting the workforce that is leaving the system right now.
You're referring to the devastating retirement processing crisis. And this was highlighted in a December 22nd letter from House Democrats to OPM Director Scott Kupor.
What's the scale of this problem?
It's staggering. The Democrats raised deep concern over major multi-month delays for thousands of retirees. And they argue these delays were exacerbated by the administration's own deferred resignation program, which incentivized all these early departures. OPM took in nearly 44,000 retirement applications in October and November alone.
44,000 in 2 months. How does that compare to normal?
It's more than triple the volume they saw in the same period in 2024. This surge is just overwhelming HR offices across the entire government. It's creating huge backlogs and enormous stress for agency HR staff who are, in many cases, dealing with staffing cuts themselves.
And the human consequence here is painful. Federal employees retire expecting their pension, and instead they're left in financial limbo for months.
OPM responded by acknowledging the long-standing challenges in the system predate this administration, which is technically true. They pointed to modernization efforts, like the online retirement application platform, and they said they're prioritizing interim pay so no one is completely without income.
But the Democrats' core argument still holds, right? That the modernization isn't enough given staffing cuts.
It isn't. Retiring employees can't get a hold of anyone to correct errors, and processing times are stretching into the better part of a year. This crisis just perfectly illustrates how a top-down workforce strategy can have severe human consequences at the agency level, and that leads directly to forceful intervention from Congress.
Congress is clearly trying to stop the bleeding, especially at the Department of Homeland Security. The Senate Appropriations Draft Homeland Security Bill, debated around December 22nd, specifically addresses the staffing crisis at FEMA.
The Senate committee expressed deep concern. FEMA has seen a mass departure of roughly 2,500 staff since the spring. They're worried staffing levels are critically insufficient to execute their missions, especially with the rising intensity of natural disasters.
So what's the fix in the bill?
They provide an extra $40 million specifically to hire staff for critical regional response and recovery positions. And crucially, the bill mandates minimum workforce maintenance levels. This is Congress trying to force an agency to staff up, regardless of the administration's preference for budget cuts.
And they try to do the exact same thing at CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency.
That's right. Senate appropriators firmly rejected the steep budget cuts the administration proposed for CISA. They allocated $2.8 billion, just below 2025 levels. And the bill then mandates maintaining staffing levels. CISA has lost about 1,000 staff, a third of its workforce, since the spring. The bill explicitly rejects cuts to the National Risk Management Center and requires CISA to maintain at least 10 regional offices and one cyber advisor per state.
It's robust bipartisan resistance to hollowing out these national security agencies, but the battle lines are also drawn very sharply over labor rights, specifically at the TSA.
On December 23rd, House Democrats publicly urged DHS and TSA to preserve the collective bargaining agreement that covers 47,000 airport screeners. The context here is that a federal court injunction is still active, blocking previous administration attempts to dissolve that agreement and implement a new, less protective labor framework for them.
So Democrats are applying political pressure to make sure that injunction holds.
Exactly. They want to ensure the current comprehensive collective bargaining agreement remains in place, especially with the January 11th deadline looming for a planned TSA action that might try to challenge the injunction.
Okay, let's pivot to one of the most astonishing figures we saw in this window. It comes from the Medicaid system. An HHS Office of Inspector General report on December 23rd revealed massive improper payments.
The scale of the waste here is just shocking. It demonstrates a staggering failure of basic data management. The report found that Medicaid programs made over $207.5 million in improper payments to providers between 2021 and 2022.
For what?
For healthcare services rendered to people who were already deceased. Since 2016, these audits have found nearly $289 million in such improper payments. They are literally paying for care for ghosts.
So Congress tried to fix this. What was the fix, and what's the paradox that's threatening it?
The fix is procedural. It's mandated in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Starting 2027, states will be legally required to audit their beneficiary list quarterly against the Social Security Full Death Master File, the DMF, to prevent this exact type of fraud.
Simple enough. Cross-reference the payment list against a death registry.
Should be. But here is the absolute paradox. At the exact same time Congress is mandating the use of the DMF to fight fraud, the Social Security Administration has been complicating the use of that very tool. The administration took an action back in April to classify thousands of living immigrants as dead in an effort to crack down on unauthorized workers.
So they're deliberately muddying the data in the very tool they need to stop the fraud.
Exactly. The government's political enforcement goals are actively undermining its own program integrity tools. It's a profound contradiction.
We also saw a lot of activity in acquisition and tech policy. The Army made a big decision on a major contracting vehicle.
Yes, on December 23rd, the Army decided to proceed with its massive $50 billion marketplace for the acquisition of professional services contract, or MAPS. This is notable because it bucks a recent trend of other agencies canceling these huge, complex contracts. The Army's confidence signals a strong belief in maintaining these vast, multi-award contracts in the defense sector.
And speaking of contracts, the GAO weighed in on the protest against GSA's low-cost awards for AI tools.
They did. The GAO dismissed the protest, which allows at least 43 agencies to keep accessing these AI tools. However, and this is important, the dismissal was on a technicality, a lack of jurisdiction over contract modifications, not on the merits of the protest itself. So while the agencies can keep using the tools, the underlying legal debate about the fairness of these massive low-cost modifications is still unresolved.
And finally, a legal check on the administration's financial policy. A lawsuit from 22 Democratic attorneys general over the plan to defund the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
The AGs argue that the CFPB director's refusal to request necessary funding from the Fed based on a flawed DOJ legal opinion threatens the Bureau's core operations. They need that funding to monitor consumer threats, protect service members, and operate the complaints system. The lawsuit argues that the administration's attempt to starve the watchdog of funds is illegal and directly harms consumers.
These interventions really show the deep entanglement between policy goals, workforce issues, and the political counterpressure trying to stabilize things. Let's broaden our view now to the economic and defense signals that were the backdrop for this entire 48-hour period.
The geopolitical escalations and these massive regulatory shifts, they were all set against surprisingly robust economic data released on December 23rd. And that certainly gave the executive branch a confidence boost.
The data was strong. Q3 GDP grew at a 4.3% annual rate, which just crushed the consensus estimate of 3.2%. That's massive growth.
And White House officials were quick to claim credit. The Council of Economic Advisers argued the administration's trade agenda and tariffs are working because the trade deficit was reduced. They also claimed the AI productivity boom is now clearly visible in the data. Kevin Hassett even claimed that the administration had outperformed Wall Street forecasts 94% of the time since September.
And that economic buffer clearly fueled market optimism, especially for the defense sector, given all the global tension.
Absolutely. The S&P 500 closed at a record high. Defense stocks, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, they saw immediate positive movement, driven directly by that $11 billion Taiwan arms sale and a related $10 billion contract ceiling increase for the C-130J that DOD awarded on the 23rd. The market immediately priced in future conflict.
Let's dig into the defense side of the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, which was recently signed. What are the key technological requirements that stand out, especially with the Taiwan crisis in mind?
The NDAA emphasizes speed and interoperability as the cornerstones of modern warfare. It cites key initiatives like Combined Joint All-Domain Command and Control, CJADC2, which is all about connecting every asset across every service. Also the Modular Open Systems Approach, MWETA, and the Sensor Open Systems Architecture, SOS. The goal is non-negotiable, making sure data moves at the speed of conflict.
But if data is moving that fast and being shared across coalitions, security has to be paramount.
Correct. The NDAA highlights critical security requirements. They mandated the need for mandatory data at rest encryption. That's securing information that's stored on devices or vehicles so it can't be exploited if hardware is captured. And even more forward-looking, the Act accelerates the urgent transition to quantum-resistant encryption.
To guard against emerging threats from quantum computing.
Exactly. It's acknowledgement that our current encryption methods have a very limited shelf life.
The NDAA also focused on how the DoD assesses its contractors on past performance.
The changes to CPARS, the Contractor Performance Assessment Reporting System, are significant. The NDAA now allows contractors to submit non-DoD or even commercial past performance data for consideration. This opens the door for companies that haven't traditionally worked with the Pentagon to win major defense contracts. It's about injecting more competition into the base.
And tied to that, we've been hearing persistent rumors about a draft executive order targeting defense contractors on cost overruns.
Sources suggest a draft EO is circulating within OMB that would specifically target executive compensation, dividends, and limit stock buybacks for defense contractors. It's an explicit attempt to address the persistent industry problem of massive cost and schedule overruns by, hitting them where it hurts, their balance sheet and their leadership pay.
Rounding out the regulatory landscape, we saw actions from two key watchdogs, the FCC and the NCUA.
The SEC was aggressive. They launched an intense crackdown on illegal robocallers, effectively disconnecting non-compliant VoIP providers from the U.S. network. They also mandated new rules requiring all VoIP providers to certify compliance with 9/11 obligations and law enforcement access requirements, closing a major security and safety gap.
And on the finance side, the National Credit Union Administration.
The NCUA announced its second round of deregulation proposals. These target what they call outdated surety and guarantor requirements to increase liquidity and lending flexibility for credit unions. At the same time, they published a proposed rule on Catastrophic Act reporting, which requires credit unions to report severe cyber attacks or major natural disasters affecting the system.
And finally, a small operational note that seems to tie back directly to that massive national security pivot we started with. The U.S. Coast Guard established a temporary safety zone off St. Thomas in the U.S. Virgin Islands.
That is a direct operational indicator. It reflects the intensified operational tempo of counter-narcotics efforts in the Caribbean, and that is likely connected to the militarized approach triggered by the fentanyl WMD designation under Title 50. When you're deploying high-value, sensitive assets for these kinds of operations, you establish safety zones.
So if we look back at these 48 hours, the dual narrative is just unmistakable. On one hand, the judiciary in Trump v. Illinois successfully constrained the administration's domestic military power. It reaffirmed core constitutional principles. But on the other, the executive branch immediately responded by projecting massive power internationally with sanctions against EU officials, that huge arms sale to Taiwan, and fundamentally restructuring domestic regulatory frameworks on drugs, space, and finance.
This was so much more than just holiday housekeeping. These actions were foundational. They were laying the groundwork for three major high-stakes conflicts that are going to define 2026. A constitutional standoff over the potential use of the Insurrection Act, a fracturing diplomatic and economic war with the EU, and a sustained and increasingly militarized crisis in the Taiwan Strait. Every action over these 2 days was an opening salvo in those larger wars.
The flurry of activity really ensured that even with the formal closure of the government, the entire machinery of state has been dramatically transformed.
And that transformation leaves us with a provocative thought for you, the listener, to mull over. The defeat the administration suffered in Chicago was both a constraint and an enablement. The check by the Supreme Court on domestic military use via Title 10 forced the executive branch to explore and utilize the full unilateral potential of Title 50 WMB designations, global sanctions, and aggressive regulatory rewriting. When one legal door is closed, the administration adapts. And the result is an even more expansive assertion of power in different, less judicially scrutinized domains. So consider what federal power looks like when it is checked and defeated by the Constitution in one critical area, yet simultaneously unleashed in all the others.